Well, good morning. This feels a little bit funny. It was actually my idea, so I guess if it doesn't work out, you can blame me. But usually you have some time to just kind of sit there and think about what you're going to say a little bit, but that's not the case this morning. That's okay. We are going to be looking in Joshua again. So for you visitors, we've been going through a series I'm calling The Story, and we're on part 29. And last time we looked at the story of the Israelites crossing the Jordan. And the point of this all is to look at how everything in the Old Testament, the story of the Exodus, how all of that points forward to the coming of Jesus. And how that there's so many things in all those stories that point forward to what Jesus came to do. Like I was saying last time, we looked at the crossing of the Jordan and how this confirmed that God wanted the Israelites to live in the land of Canaan, where God would live with them and be their God. And you remember the incredible way that God did this by piling up the waters of the flooded Jordan at that time, and making a giant wall of water almost 18 miles upstream. And we looked at how that event showed that Joshua was a replacement for Moses, because God told Joshua exactly what would happen before it happened, and then Joshua relayed that to the Israelites before it happened, and then it all happened exactly the way he said it. So that showed the Israelites that God was with Joshua and that he was the new leader for them. It was interesting, last month, I think it was the 24th, we looked at that story in Joshua 3, and then on Tuesday we flew out to Montana for the ministers' meetings out there, and on Wednesday morning, our first session, I think it was, Phil actually talked on this very same thing. It was kind of interesting to just have studied that, and then he shared a really encouraging session there with us on that very same thing. And he kind of looked at how God worked through Joshua to direct the people, and specifically to look at the Ark of the Covenant as God's presence. We looked at that a little bit too, but how that was what was leading the people. It was really neat to see how God had given that message to Phil right after we had looked at it as well. Anyway, I was actually planning to jump right into Jericho, but as is usually the case, once you start getting into the details of what leads up to it, there's more there than you think when you start. So we're actually not even going to quite get into Jericho. And I didn't have as much time to prepare for this as I hoped to, so if it's a little bit disjointed, forgive me, but there's some really neat stuff here, and I want to dive into this. If you want to turn to Joshua 4, I'm going to read from 19 to the end of the chapter. So Joshua 4, 19 to 24. It says, "Then the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, 'When your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know. Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever.'" Do you think any of these people that experienced this amazing miracle would have forgotten in their lifetime, would have forgotten what happened here? I don't think so. I mean, that's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime deal. None of these people would have seen the Red Sea. They would have heard about it, but this was their version of the Red Sea. I don't think they would have forgotten about it. And I'm pretty sure they would have told their children about it. So why do you think God, I guess it doesn't specifically say that God told Joshua to do this, but Joshua had the men bring these stones and set up this monument. You know, when I you or I do something that's kind of really neat or really cool, we usually find a way to tell someone, right? Well, if it's someone close to you, you'll just straight up tell them. If it's maybe in a setting or whatever that it sounds a little bit like bragging, you'll figure out a way to kind of weave it into a conversation. That's just how we are. If we do something like that, we're going to tell somebody. We might not always post it out there on social media or something, but we'll figure out a way to let people know. What about when God does something amazing? Sometimes when prayers are answered or good things happen in our lives, it's sometimes a little bit hard to know if that was specifically God intervening and changing what would have already happened, or if it was God actually, you know, changing the course of events because of us asking him to. But other times, you just know that it's God. You know that God moved and things happened. Things were on a direction that were not good, and God changed that. Do we remember those things? And maybe more importantly, do we tell them to the people around us and to our children? Are those stories passed down to our children and our grandchildren? And I don't think any of us have had quite an experience like the Israelites did there, but we've seen God move. I think all of us have seen those times when we know that God intervened and God moved. And we'll celebrate it at the time. We'll maybe tell somebody about it. But do we remember them longer than maybe a year or a couple months? And do we continue to tell those things to our children and our grandchildren? Maybe it seems a little bit presumptuous, but I think more of us should write books. Not in the sense of this is about me and my life and how important I am. But what if we wrote books that are a collection of stories of how God moved in our lives? Wouldn't have to be something you published and sold even, but something that you could pass down to your children and say, this is what God did in my lifetime, in our lifetime. Don't forget this. Pass this on down. I think that would be a good thing to do. And I think sometimes it would have to be an intentional thing, but it would need to be something that is continually added to. Maybe like a diary that you know is going to get passed down, but you know, focusing on those events that you don't want to forget, that you know that God worked. Not making it about you, but about what God did. Essentially, that's what the Bible is. It's a series of stories of how God worked. And I think we all have those things. So maybe more of us should be writing books. And if those stories could remind us and our grandchildren, our children and our grandchildren, to fear the Lord your God forever, then we're following that command of making that monument. Moving into chapter 5 here, I'm going to read verse 1. It says, as soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. When I started thinking about this whole timeline of events, I wondered why the Canaanites didn't just immediately band together when they saw the Israelites crossing the Jordan. Like, why didn't they just quickly form an army and go racing out to meet them before they were all over? Like, they would have been, you know, focusing on getting across and then having to set up camp and all that stuff. Why didn't they go attack them right away before they had time to form back up and, you know, the Israelites to create an army? And I think that verse kind of explains it. If you knew And I think it makes sense. If you knew that your enemy who was coming to take over your land had this supernatural force that could stop rivers and, you know, make a riverbed completely dry all in a few seconds, you would probably try to avoid starting a war with them. And I think that's why it says that their hearts just melted within them. I thought I came across in a commentary I was reading on Joshua 5, it really kind of hit me. And I think it kind of explains why the rest of the events that happen in 5 and then the beginning of 6, well, I guess mainly 5, why they happened in that order and why God had it happen in this order. So the thought is this: God was more interested in conquering the Israelites than he was in conquering the land of Canaan. I'll just say that again. God was more interested in conquering the Israelites than he was in conquering the land of Canaan. Now, God had made a promise 700 years earlier, approximately, to Abraham that he was going to give them this land of Canaan. Why did it take him 700 years to get them there? Do you think God didn't have the strength to move these people in there quickly and conquer the land? I don't think so. I think we know that God is strong enough to do that. Why did it take all these series of events, being in Egypt for that long, being slaves, being freed from that, you know, crossing the Red Sea, and then even, well, we'll look at that a little bit later, but I think the reason was God was preparing a people. He was more interested in actually preparing the people than he was in preparing the land. That was going to be part of it. But he had to prepare the people before they could actually take the land and he could live with them. There's a number of things that happen right after the Israelites crossed the Jordan that I think kind of shows this, along with all the events that happened before this that we kind of already looked at. The first one here, as far as after crossing the Jordan, before the Israelites could go into Canaan, well, I guess this was before, they had to walk around in the desert and completely trust God for their food. We haven't read this yet, but they've been receiving manna all the way up until they settle into Canaan a little bit here. They set up a camp, and then it says that that's when God stopped sending manna because they had food from the land. But all that time, they have been completely trusting in God to provide for their needs. And you remember that they came up to the Jordan and then sent the spies over, and the spies were all worried about not being able to take the land because of the giants in it and all that. And so then the people freak out and basically throw a fit about why Moses has brought them here to die. And what's really interesting is they specifically say, "Would that we had died in Egypt or died in the wilderness." And so God ends up letting them have that. He lets them die in the wilderness. I never actually noticed this when we studied that part of it, but God sends them back out into the wilderness. They have to wander around for 40 years until all those people that complained had died in the wilderness. So they got their wish in that sense. But there's a line. Trying to find the verse here. Anyway, it says that he rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. I think it's in Joshua 5. We haven't read this yet, but 5 verse 9. It says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you.' And so the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day." What does that mean? Why did God need to roll away the reproach of Egypt? Well, I think there was still a desire in that original group that came out of Egypt to go right back to it, because it's what they knew, even though they were slaves. There's several times where they complain about not having the food that they had back in Egypt, or, you know, at least the safety, relative safety. God had to remove that from them before he could take them into a better land. And it looks like God did that in that time in the wilderness and leading up to crossing the Jordan. And you'll notice that the second time they come up to the Jordan, they don't throw a fit. They don't freak out and believe that God isn't going to take care of them. They just follow exactly what Joshua tells them to do. So something had changed there. And I think that's what's referenced there in that rolling away the reproach of Egypt. And there's a lot of stuff I'm sure we could learn from that in our own lives. We'll look at that maybe a little bit later. But the second point I have here in relation to that is that God has the Israelites cross the Jordan right in front of Jericho, which was probably the strongest military fortification in the land there in Canaan. And that took a complete faith in God that he wouldn't allow them to be killed as soon as they cross into this land. He could have had the Israelites, you know, cross the Jordan up or down, not right in front of Jericho. But he specifically chooses to do that. And that took a lot of faith on the Israelites. And at one point they didn't have that, but they do now. Third point I have here is that God tells Joshua to have all the men circumcised right after crossing into enemy territory. And this took even more faith that God would protect the people because they followed his command, and it appears that they do it without questioning. And so you basically put them out of commission for a while here, right in front of their enemies. That took a complete faith in God as well. And then the fourth one I have here is that they celebrate the Passover. I guess I should have just read. Why don't we just read those verses? It's in Joshua 5, starting in verse 10. It says, "While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month, in the evening on the plains of Jericho, and the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year." Obviously, we know what the Passover was about. And this wouldn't have been just a quick, you know, evening church service. I don't know exactly how long it would have taken then, but now, as I understand, it's like a seven-day thing, or eight, depending on how you count it. And it's like a holiday. Everyone takes off, and so it's a whole process. They were, you know, making these special meals. They had to kill the animals. There's preparation that goes into removing all the leaven, everything that went with that. So this was not just a quick thing that they did. This is, maybe it wasn't a full 7 days, I'm not sure on that, but it would have been a multiple day thing. And, you know, during this time, you would think that the Canaanites would have been, you know, getting their armies ready, you know, getting their weapons ready. You know, if I were thinking about what's the best strategy here, I would be like, first thing you do is go conquer. I mean, don't wait for them to get their armies figured out and get a plan together. Go do what you are here to do immediately. But again, this was not God's plan. God wanted them to wait on him. And again, I think just another showing of how important this was to God to prepare the Israelites more than to prepare the land of Canaan. And it was a long process. It took hundreds of years. But God had gotten them to a place of what looks like complete trust in him. They just obeyed his commands. This point really kind of gets hammered home with the next section here. I'm going to read from 13 down through 15, Joshua 5. It says, "When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went up to him and said to him, 'Are you for us or for our adversaries?' And he said, 'No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come.' And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, 'What does my Lord say to his servant?' And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, 'Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." Verse just kind of break that down a little bit. Verse 13 says that Joshua was by Jericho, and we aren't exactly told what he was doing there, but we could maybe guess or assume that he was kind of scouting out the land a little bit to see what was going to be the best play or the best way to take the city of Jericho. Do they, you know, set up a siege or try to bust through the walls or climb over it or something? And we'll look at this hopefully next time, but this was a massive fortified city. It wasn't just a small wall around this. This was a huge thing. So he was possibly checking this out, and Joshua was walking along, and suddenly there was a man with a drawn sword in front of him. Now, I've never been out walking on a bike trail or something, and suddenly there's a guy standing in front of me with a sword drawn. That's never actually happened to me, but I'm pretty sure if it did, I think I would quickly remember that the bank's closing pretty soon, and I needed to head the other direction. I don't think I would walk up to him and ask him what he's doing. But I think it shows the courage of Joshua, for one thing. He had a plan, or he had a goal here, and he knew that God was asking them to conquer the land, and he wasn't going to shrink back from that. He just walks up to him and asks him this question. And it's a famous question. I'm sure you've heard, maybe even heard this preached on, but that question, are you for us or for our adversaries? But it's the response, I think, that is so interesting, and the point, or why this account is even here. Verse 14, it says, he just says no. I think the King James has it as nay. The NIV actually translated it as neither, but as I understand it, that's not actually the best translation. It maybe makes it clearer, because it specifically answers the question that he asks. But I think, as I understand it, no is actually the best translation for that. And I think the point there, well, think about why Joshua was asking that question. Now, they're in a land where pretty much everyone wants to see them dead. And Joshua is probably a little bit on edge. He doesn't know when or if the Canaanites will try to ambush them. Or try to start this war that he knows has to be coming. And if this man is an enemy, then Joshua needs to get out his own sword and confront it. If he's a friend, then Joshua is probably ready to give him commands, because he is the commander of this army. Sometimes, though, the questions that we ask are just plain the wrong questions. You've probably experienced this. Somebody asks you a question, and you don't know how to answer it because the question has a premise that isn't even right to start with. It doesn't make sense to answer it because it's the wrong question. And that was the case here. Jesus actually had a great way of, I guess, pushing back on that when the Pharisees would ask him questions that were obviously just meant to trap him. There's a number of times where that happens. They would ask him these ridiculous questions or set up these crazy scenarios and then, you know, try to get him into a place where answering this way would be, you know, bad for him, and answering this way would also be bad for him. He always had a way of just saying, you guys, you don't have it figured out here. That's not even the right question. And that simple no, it just shows that Joshua had this whole question wrong. And the rest of the answer brings some clarity to why it was the wrong question. It's an interesting line, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. And that little sentence or phrase, that packs a pretty big punch, because that means a lot of things. First of all, it gives some clues to who this man actually is. It doesn't straight up say it, but it gives some pretty big clues as to who it actually is. And that changes everything. And secondly, it tells us that God isn't interested in human sides when it comes to our little squabbles or fights here. And I'm not trying to say that what the Israelites were facing here in the war with, or the coming war with the Canaanites, was just a little squabble. That was something that they were commanded to do. But the point was, God is thinking much bigger than that. He wasn't here to be on one side or the other. I think too often, or often, at least I look at any conflict and I try to figure out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in this fight. Often, if it's something that you're close enough to, you yourself are kind of pushed into having to pick a side on a fight, or even think about right now with what Israel is facing and the war there. You know, it's easier to just be like, well, these are the good guys and anything they do is going to be good. But that's not really how God works. And I think it also maybe limits our ability to think clearly when that's the case. If we just simply pick a side and believe that everything on that side is good and anything on the other side is automatically evil, sometimes we miss out on the complexity of the situation. And I'm not necessarily trying to push us into feeling like we have to stick up for both sides or whatever in this current conflict or any of the conflicts. But I think often, like, especially if here in our country, if the United States is involved in a conflict somewhere, my immediate assumption is that, well, we're the good guys. And I think that's somewhat arrogant, for one thing, but it's also missing the point. Like, if we're part of a different kingdom, like, choosing to take a side there is missing the point that we're part of something else, and God doesn't think that way. He has his own army, and that is always going to be the good guys. To some degree, the world is always going to be the bad guys. And so picking a side here, although there's sometimes, you know, clearly differences there of good and evil, but as a whole, that doesn't fit that neatly, because we're all fallen and we all make mistakes. The question is not whether God is on our side. The question is really whether we're on God's side. Are we part of his kingdom and working toward that? Or do we have our own thing going and we're asking God to come be on our side and give us what we need? And I think that was what changed for Joshua here. And we see that his immediate response is that he falls down and worships. Suddenly what he wanted and what he thought was important didn't matter anymore, because someone greater was there. So that kind of brings us to the question of who is this man that's meeting him. And I'd never thought much about this, but when I was first reading it, I guess I just assumed it was an angel, maybe Michael or one of the archangels. However, there's some clues here that I think make a pretty strong case that it wasn't actually an angel. And that makes this actually much more interesting, I think. So when Joshua hears who this man is, he falls down and worships him. Now, there's other times in the Bible when an angel would visit someone and the person tries to worship him. One example I thought of just off the top of my head was John, when the angel comes to help him kind of tour heaven. He tries to fall down and worship this angel, and the angel immediately stops him and says, "No, don't worship me. I'm not God." And I think there's some other examples of that too. I'm thinking maybe there's one in Daniel, or maybe it wasn't Daniel. Anyway, anytime that someone wants to worship the messenger as an angel, that angel would always stop that person and not let them worship him. But that doesn't happen here. So that's one clue. By the way, the one about John is in Revelation 22, verse 8, if you want to take a look at that. But secondly, there's a man, or this man tells Joshua to take off his sandals because he's on holy ground. Can you think of another time when that happened? Obviously, we looked at the account of Moses when God comes in the form of that burning bush, and that's the first thing that Moses is told to do is take off his sandals. because he's on holy ground. And again, I don't think that would be happening if this were an angel. So I think that leaves us with two options. If it's the commander of the armies of the Lord, it has to be either God himself, God the Father, or Jesus. And I think when I first saw the theory about it being Jesus, I thought that almost seemed a little bit, how can that be? Because Jesus hadn't come in the flesh yet. Like, how can this be a man when Jesus hadn't come to earth yet? But then I thought through some other examples, and there are other times where it looks like Jesus came in the form of a man. The first one I thought of was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It says that when they were in the fiery furnace there, the king who had thrown them in there saw a form of someone that looked like the Son of God. And I think that's pretty well accepted as Jesus. So it's certainly not the first time that Jesus showed himself in the form of a man. Now, I think we should be very clear. I don't think this was actually a physical body in the sense of Jesus coming in the flesh like he did when he was born. But it was in the likeness of a man. And I think there's also a good case that Jesus is the one speaking to Moses when he stops him from killing Isaac, which would actually, it just beautifully lines up the story because Jesus ends up being that lamb. And I won't go into the details of that necessarily, but if you want to go look at that account, there's some clues there that would point toward that actually being Jesus that told Moses to stop when he was about to kill Isaac there. There's other times where the phrase is translated angel of the Lord. That phrase you see fairly often through the Old Testament. And it actually, I mean, that's confusing because it sounds like an angel. I mean, it's just straight up called an angel of the Lord. But as I understand it, that phrase could actually be translated or be understood as the Son of God. And again, I'm not an Old Testament scholar, so I couldn't dive into the details of the Hebrew and why that is, but that's what I read. But the last point I have on that is when God the Father makes himself known to other people in the Old Testament, it wasn't in the form of a man that I could think of anyway. God did reveal himself in a degree to Moses and maybe in some ways to Daniel as well, but he doesn't take on the form of a physical man necessarily. It's usually, for the Israelites in general, I guess it was the pillar of fire and then cloud by day. It was, lightnings and thunderings and a very real and strong presence, but not in the form of a man. So I think that's another clue that would maybe point to this being Jesus that is actually appearing to Joshua here. So what does this actually, how does this apply to us? Well, I think part of the lesson of this account is, like we already looked at a little bit, is to remind us that God, when God does amazing things, he's doing it for his own glory. He's not doing it for ours. That line, now I have come, that man says there, indicates that this isn't the Israelites' battle to fight. It's kind of a nuanced thing there, but he says, no, I'm not for you, and I'm not for your enemies. I am the commander of the armies of the Lord. Now I have come. And I think that now I have come is indicating that, okay, now we can get this thing started. This war is about to begin because I have come, not because you guys are here. And then, of course, we know what happens next in Jericho. I mean, they march around it, but they don't do any of the fighting. The whole thing just collapses. And it wasn't their own strength. They would play a role as helpers and as people that obeyed what God asked them to do. But it wasn't their fight. It wasn't their battle to win. I think it's tempting for us to think that when God moves and does great things, like answering prayers or maybe even a healing or whatever, it's because God is on our side and it makes us feel good. And there's a sense where that's the case. you know, we are children of God, and God has given us promises that he would be with us and protect us, defend us even. So in a sense, yes, God is on our side. God is for us. But in the broader sense, it's God does not do great things because we are the good guys. God does great things because he wants the glory for himself. In fact, the very fact that we can be a church and be part of this kingdom is for God's glory. It has really nothing to do with us and how good we are, right? And I know that that's maybe a fine line to walk sometimes, trusting that God has promised that he will be with us and protect us and do good things for us. But there can be a sense of arrogance in that, I think, that we have to be careful of. As we do the things that God has asked us to do, and we see him work among us, and maybe even sometimes through us, it's easy to get this mentality that, okay, well, I must be the good person here, and anyone that comes against me, they're the bad guys. No, God chooses to work through who he chooses to work through. We were just having this discussion a little bit, Vadim and I. God is doing some amazing things with providing attorneys and stuff for the situation there with Victor's, and it's through somebody that is not even a believer. And so, you know, we've questioned, well, how does that work? I mean, I think God would have also probably provided through the believers if that's what needed to happen. So is that actually God's will? You know, how can God work through somebody? And I'm sure you've all seen examples of this where God works through somebody that later you discover is not even really in the will of God. Maybe they're working against in some ways in the background. I mean, I was, when I became a Christian, the man that was preaching, later a lot of stuff came out that was very questionable and kind of very disheartening, actually. And yet God saved me through that, through his preaching. How does that work? I don't know, but God still got the glory, I think. And maybe in some ways it made it clear that, you know, my salvation experience was not because of that man, even though God worked through him. It wasn't because of him or because he was such a powerful, you know, man of God necessarily. God can choose to work through who he can choose to work through. And he does get the glory in the end. And so I think there needs to be a humility on our part as God works through us and does those amazing things to give that glory back to him and to make it clear to our children and our grandchildren that God is the one doing this. It's not because of what we've done here. I'd like to bring it back to the first verses we looked at there in chapter 4, verse 21 to 24. I'll just read those again. This is back where they, just after they had crossed the Jordan. And he said to the people of Israel, "When your children ask their fathers in times to come, 'What do these stones mean?' then you shall let your children know, 'Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty,'" not our own hand, "'the hand of the Lord is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever.'" Let's remember that to tell each other of those things. I know that sometimes when the thing happens, we share it with each other, but can we keep sharing those things to remind us again of what God has done in the past and tell our children and maybe get to work on that book? And remember that God does great things for his own glory. And I'm hoping maybe during the rest of our worship time and testimony time, be thinking about those things. Even if you've shared it before, share them again. Remind all of us of the things that God has done and point the glory back to him. So that's what I have. God bless you.